The social worker was older than she had expected. Perhaps the nameless official who arranged these matters thought that greying hair and menopausal plumpness might induce confidence in the adopted adults who came for their compulsory counselling. After all, they must be in need of reassurance of some kind, these displaced persons whose umbilical cord was a court order. Or why had they troubled to travel this bureaucratic road to identity? The social worker smiled her encouraging professional smile. She said, holding out her hand, "My name is Naomi Henderson, and you're Miss Philippa Rose Palfrey. I'm afraid I have to begin by asking you for some proof of identity." Philippa nearly replied, "Philippa Rose Palfrey is what I'm called. I'm here to find out who I am." But checked herself in time, sensing that such an affectation would be an unpropitious beginning to the interview. They both knew why she was here. And she wanted the session to be a success, wanted it to go her way, without being precisely clear what way that was. She unclipped the fastening of her leather shoulder bag and handed over in silence her passport and the newly acquired driving license. The attempt at reassuring informality extended to the furnishing of the room. There was an official-looking desk, but Miss Henderson had moved from behind it as soon as Philippa was announced, and had motioned her to one of the two vinyl-covered armchairs on each side of a low table. There were even flowers on the table, in a small blue bowl lettered, "A present from Polpero." It held a mixed bunch of roses. These weren't the scentless, thornless buds of the florist window. These were garden roses, recognized from the garden at Caldecott Terrace. Peace, Superstar, Albertine. The blossoms, overblown, already peeling, with only one or two tightly furled buds, darkening at the lips, and destined never to open. Philippa wondered if the social worker had brought them in from her own garden. Perhaps she was retired, living in the country, and had been recruited part-time for this particular job. She could picture her clumping round her rose bed in the brogues and serviceable tweeds she was wearing now, snipping away at roses which were due for culling, might just last out the London day. Someone had watered the flowers over enthusiastically. A milky bead lay like a pearl between two yellow petals, and there was a splash on the tabletop. But the imitation mahogany wouldn't be stained. It wasn't really wood. The roses gave forth a damp sweetness, but they weren't really fresh. In these easy chairs, no visitor had ever sat at ease. The smile which invited her confidence and trust across the table was bestowed by courtesy of Section 26 of the Children Act 1975. She had taken trouble with her appearance, but then she always did, presenting herself to the world with self-conscious art, daily remaking herself in her own image. The aim this morning had been to suggest that no trouble had in fact been taken, that this interview had induced no special anxiety, warranted no exceptional care. Her strong corn-coloured hair, bleached by the summer so that no two strands were exactly the same gold, were drawn back from a high forehead and knotted in a single heavy plait. The wide mouth, with its strong curved upper lip and sensuous droop at each corner, was devoid of lipstick. But she had applied her eyeshadow with care, emphasizing her most remarkable feature, the luminous, slightly protuberant green eyes. Her honey-colored skin glistened with sweat. She had lingered too long in the embankment gardens, unwilling to arrive early, and in the end she had had to hurry. She wore sandals and a pale green open-necked cotton shirt above her corduroy trousers. In contrast to this casual informality, the careful ambiguity about money or social class were the possessions which she wore like talismans: the slim gold watch, the three heavy Victorian rings, topaz, carnelian, peridot, the leather Italian bag slung from her left shoulder. The contrast was deliberate. The advantage of remembering virtually nothing before her eighth birthday, the knowledge that she was illegitimate, meant that there was no phalanx of the living dead, no pious ancestor worship, no conditioned reflexes of thought to inhibit the creativity with which she presented herself to the world. What she aimed to achieve was singularity, an impression of intelligence, a look that could be spectacular, even eccentric, but never ordinary. Her file, clean and new, lay open before Miss Henderson. Across the table, Philippa could recognize some of the contents: the orange and brown government information sheet, a copy of which she had obtained from a citizen's advice bureau in North London, where there had been no risk that she would be known or recognised. Her letter to the Registrar General, written 5 weeks ago, the day after her 18th birthday, in which she had requested the application form, which was the first document to identity. A copy of the form itself. The letter was tagged on top of the file, stark white against the buff of bureaucracy. Miss Henderson fingered it. Something about it, the address, the quality of the heavy linen-based paper, apparent even in a copy, evoked, Philippa thought, a transitory unease. Perhaps it was a recognition that her adoptive father was Maurice Palfrey. Given Maurice's indefatigable self-advertisement, the stream of sociological publications which flowed from his department, it would be odd if a senior social worker hadn't heard of him.